The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchen.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach, and technique.
And welcome to this episode, episode 57. And this month we're speaking to Gugi Wationgo, one of East Africa's finest writers. We spoke back in May, I believe, and had a pretty far-reaching conversation. I think he's 85 now. He's certainly got quite a bit of experience across the decades of writing and across quite an interesting life.
Well, I think we spoke to him when he decamped out to a hotel, I believe. I can't remember exactly what sort of structural household issue he was having off the top of my head, but he had to hit the road for a bit, and it meant that we had some technical issues. So unlike our usual way of recording, unfortunately, this was a Microsoft Teams conversation that we recorded and have then sort of pieced back together. So some of the sound quality is maybe slightly more variable than in other episodes, but it was great to have a chat with him, hear about his experiences as I think the first writer in the Kikuyu language of a novel, which is always going to be an interesting thing to hear about. Someone who did hard time. He got sent to maximum security prison, as he says, for writing a play in the Kikuyu language, and how that shaped how he felt about language. And we had quite a good chat about the politics of language, essentially.
Without any further ado, we give you Gugi Wationgo.
We often begin with just asking how you got into writing and seeing yourself as a writer. What was the process to that?
I've written about this, actually, in my memoir, Birth of a Dreamweaver. But I grew up in a storytelling environment. My father had four wives. So I grew up in a community of one father, four mothers. And in our elder mother's house, we used to gather there for storytelling up virtually every evening. Yeah. So I started by storytelling or hearing stories, and I loved so much. I was a very poor storyteller. But there was another problem we had, that stories could only be told in the evening when all the chores are done. But I wanted to hear stories all the time. So it was wonderful for me when I was able to read, and I could read stories to myself in daytime. I could tell my stories anytime I wanted. And some of my earlier stories, which I really like, written ones, that is, are from the Old Testament. Everything there was completely magical to me. It was like magic, magic realism. You have heard of the magic realism school of writing right now. Actually, the Old Testament is in that category of magic realism because it's a text where you could find Daniel in the den of lions and nothing touches him. Or John in the belly of the fish, or is John in the belly of a fish? And then he comes on and I say, he comes out. Me, those stories are still very magical to me. And I was able to get them now from books. Later, I would graduate from the Old Testament to novels by Stevenson about pirates and Jim Hawkins and others. Anyway, story by Stevenson.
Is that Treasure Island? Is that
Treasure Island? Treasure Island, yeah. That fascinated me so much that a friend of mine and I, Kenneth, was my childhood friend, had these dreams of becoming pirates. But we didn't. The problem, there was no sea around. I came from the mountains. There's no sea, only rivers and so on. But you want to be out there in the sea, not just any sea sailor, but pirates. But piracy looks so attractive. So adventurous, right? So in fact, my first initial interest in writing came from reading Stevenson. And my friend and I, Kenneth, used to debate about writing. even when we were in the primary school. The problem was we had an argument because I told him, if one, you cannot write without license to write. You know, unless you, I used to think that writing is like whenever you graduate a class and then you can go to school, you graduate and then you are certified doctor or certified accountant, then you can do it. So I thought you would also become a certified writer. And he was telling me, no, you cannot be imprisoned for writing. And I said, no, you will be imprisoned if you write without a license, right?
but you did start very early then, didn't you? I mean, not necessarily from primary school, but I remember from Birth of a Dreamweaver, you were very prolific at writing, even as an undergraduate at university.
When I go to university, at Makerere University, which is a branch of the University of London at that time, and I become a student of English, and that's where it all started. Because by then, I've come into contact with Caribbean writers like George Lamming in The Curse of My Skin, African writers like Chinua Achebe, Things Fall Apart, or Peter Abrahams from South Africa. It was very exciting to see. So it was almost like you did it because it was being done. The Makerere University, the Department of English, also used to have a magazine for students called Pen Point. And there I saw my fellow students, or those who are senior to us, had written stories. Writers like John Nagenda of Uganda, or the late Jonathan Carriera of Kenya, they published in Pen Point. It was there. You know, I could write and hopefully get it published in Pen Point. And that's where I actually started writing for Pen Point in Makerere.
But you didn't feel the need to sort of wait for permission to write. By that point, your mindset obviously must have changed quite a lot from I need to be certified by this.
It's very funny because my friend Kenneth, when we went to high school, he didn't go to high school, but he went to teacher training college. And from there, he started writing a novel to prove to me that one could write without being imprisoned. So, and he did write a chapter. I can't remember what the novel was about, but he did write a chapter to prove to me that one did not need a permission to write. Yeah. But the irony, of course, is that in the end, I was proved right because years later, I would be put in a maximum security prison.
That's a different side of it.
Yeah.
For writing. So, yeah. So, in a way, I was right. But of course, he was right as well. Yeah.
And did you find it quite easy to get into the process of writing from the initial sort of reading Treasure Island as a child and enjoying it? Was there a sort of leap you had to take to actually getting the words down on page, or did it come quite naturally?
I came across George Lamming and Caribbean writers at Makerere at college, and they opened a new world to me of possibilities, especially the work of George Lamming, who died recently, by the way, in The Curse of My Skin, had such an impression in my mind that I wanted to do a similar thing for my village. What he did for the village in Barbados, I wanted to do for my village in Kenya that I grew up. But with writing, of course, you do one thing, you start one thing, and then you find it morphs into something else. Mm. So The River Between just came like that. The River Between, I was going to write. The initial story I was going to write was about my present, you know, growing up in a colonial rule and that kind of thing. The novel that came actually was not about my present life then as a child, but pre. So that's what I was talking about, the coming of missionaries and the early contact between colonial cultures and African cultures. Yeah.
The process of writing that, was it? A case of lots of drafts and trying lots of things.
Let me tell you how it actually came to write. Actually, there was a student in Makerere, my senior, called Jonathan Carriera. He's one of the contributors to Pen Point. He was senior. In fact, he was one of the editors. And in those days, when you are junior and everyone is writing for Pen Point, you are in awe of those who write for Pen Point. So one day I meet him in the corridors of the university and I'm so odd, I'm lost for words, and I want to speak to him, but I don't know what to tell him. There's a big writer. So I tell him a lie, a bit of fiction. I tell him, Jonah, I have written a story. Would you like to look at it? And he said, of course, do you have it? He was so enthusiastic. Oh, my God. The problem is I had not written it. That's on my mind. I had to go and write a story to give it to him, right? And that was actually the beginning of my writing, a story I called The Fig Tree, or Mugumo as currently. Yeah. And then I took it to him, Jonathan, who of course made very good comments. I had no concept of what a story is like, but he made very good comments, really. And that really helped me a lot.
And were you sort of happy to get that feedback? I was wondering perhaps if the fact that you, I'm not going to say you dashed it off, but because it's not a story that you'd written 5 years ago and were really protective of, perhaps you were more sort of receptive to someone giving you some guidance at that point.
No. Comment, I've always, even now, I'm at 85, I thrive on people's responses to what I write. And it started then when Jonah Carriera made such eye-opening comments on the story. I remember him asking me, so what happens? You can't just write a story and say, I went to London and came back to Leeds. But what happened? Something must have happened to change you. What, you know, he asked me such pointed questions that really set me on to thinking more concretely about storytelling in written form. The whole idea of irony, the reversal of expectations, that kind of thing. You cannot simply say, I went to London and then came back in the evening. So what? What happened? Did something happen to change you? What? Something must have happened to make it, you look at it either differently or something. So he was the first to teach me about irony in storytelling, or the difference between expectation and reality, that collision between expectation and reality. It was like a fellow student, but I see a student who taught me that particular aspect.
I mean, he obviously really understood how the kind of mechanics of storytelling, what gives it the richness.
Irony, especially irony, the difference between expectation, reality. I'm going to meet, say, Markham was going to interview me for a podcast. And I'm thinking, and I said, dreaming how it's going to be a wonderful podcast and so on. And then I put my machine on, doesn't work. Huh? Because I forgot to ask how, or something happens that reverses the expectations. That was very important to me. It's still very important. I tell it to them.
How do you go by on a practical level with if you're writing something, do you sort of write multiple drafts until you get to that works well, or is it a case of going for a long walk and letting the ideas go around your head, and then you have it, you put pen to paper?
I'm a reviser. I write paragraph after paragraph, chapter after chapter, and even when I have finished, I sometimes revise the whole novel several times. I'll take one example of that. My third novel is called A Grain of Wheat. I wrote it when I was a postgraduate student at Leeds. I sent it. I remember sending that novel, thinking it was complete, to my publisher. And they accepted it. And it was in print. And when I got in those days, they used to send you proofs first and then something until what they call page proofs. Well, you can't really change thereafter. You cannot change. It will cost you money. If you, the writer, changes, you got to meet the cost of the new changes. So I got my novel, page three, so almost ready. It was coming out. Then I saw a defect. So I recorded the novel, page proof stage. And I couldn't live without the changes. So I recorded the novel. I did it all over again, right? So they charged me, I'd pay for my royalties.
So it's quite a fundamental change. Was that like a structural change, or you'd realize there was something inconsistent?
That's a structural change, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I was so glad I changed it, you know. And now I went and looked at it, oh my God, that was just sheer luck.
Because that feels like the sort of thing that would really eat away at you. If you'd let that go and then...
you guys would just... I'd be fine, right? But let me say for myself, I just, oh my God, I wouldn't like to think about it because I would feel something would pain. I would call it, I don't call it pain or something else. Oh, I should have changed this. I should have, you know. I was very happy, actually, that I lost money, but I was very happy that I did it that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the integrity of the work was the important thing at the end of it.
It would always remind me thereafter about when I was a change. They wanted to be sure that finally, the final thing, yeah, is this final? Yes. But they know me that I revise at all times. Yeah. Yeah. But not in a revisionist manner, but I mean, I'm a reviser of my works.
And at the sort of at the very beginning of the stage, are you, how much sort of planning do you do? Do you plot things out and have a sort of a chart?
No, I don't. I don't have a chart. Every time, I tried once that charting business and nothing came of it. Yeah.
But I guess it's worth a try to see if that technique does add something. You tried it, yeah.
It's something like an image. Or something ironic, something happens, and I'm exploring it. So I don't. Let me give you an example of my latest. One of my novels is called Wizard of the Crow. Wizard of the Crow. Gerald Nkoyo, another title. Morogiwaka Gogo. That novel, I remember very, very well how it came about. Between A Grain of Wheat, and I wrote another novel called Petal of the Blood, but then thereafter, there was a very big gap, okay? And I thought my creativity had dried up. So my then wife, Jerry, we lived in New Jersey at the time, and she told me to take her to see her doctor. She lived in the US for many years, but I came from Kenya, and in Kenya, at least when I was growing up, you just don't, this to be laughable. If you say you're going to a doctor for a checkup, unless you are ill or something, why would you do that kind of thing? So I was just taking her to a doctor, her doctor in New Jersey. And then she told him, I remember this one, check him as well. It was so funny because I wasn't feeling ill at all, nothing, you know, nothing. But when he came back with the results or whatever, his face was had prostate cancer, fell at the level, okay? And so, like, it's not curable, more or might. They couldn't move the prostate to reach a stage where I think got into my glands or something. I think I was given literally 3 months for the advanced stage of the cancer. That evening, believe it or not, when we went home, New Jersey, then I took my pen, I then used to write by hand and wrote the first line of what became the novel, Wizard of the Crow. Mm-hmm. And what was the what's, and it went beyond the 3 months. It went for years. It took about 5 to 6 years to finish the novel, both in its equal original and also English version. In other words, that was not something I'd prepared for. Or it just came that evening. I remember that even very vividly because I'm going home in a kind of despair, and I get a pen and I start writing a novel. So it's going to be my farewell novel, right? Kind of thing.
I mean, that's an extreme thing to, an extreme solution to a creative block. But perhaps the illness was, like you said, you're sort of, you'd felt creatively sort of dried up and it just wasn't working for you. I wonder if the illness, if there were some other effects on your sort of brain or, yeah, your neurologically or something.
I mean, a writer's block, it can take a year, months or whatever. But what I remember is just getting a pen that, it's the idea of having 3 months to live. Mm-hmm. I wanted one more novel, and then the first line. In fact, the novel, Wizard of the Crow, is so much about illness of various kinds. Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously the sort of preoccupations that you were working through then. But did you, with the 3 months, I know obviously that's just a sort of notional thing when the doctors say that to you, but did you have a shape of a novel in your mind that you thought was achievable in 3 months when you started?
The infrastructure, I don't know what it was, like the realization I had only 3 months to live. And that was the key. Can I do one more novel before I die?
I guess, thankfully, obviously the
prognosis of 3 months was wrong. But did it last throughout the 5 or 6 years that you were writing? Or
I'm glad they were wrong, of course. The novel Faisal took me about 5 years to complete.
And did you have that hanging over you that for that 5 years, or was it kind of quickly resolved after 6 months or something?
They couldn't remove the prostate, but they could give me some pills. And I'm still on pills even today. Yeah, to this day, almost 20 years after or 22 years after, I'm still on pills. Yeah.
So was that same feeling for the 5 or 6 years you were writing it? Were you still kind of fueled by that same feeling, or was that just the initial feeling that once you realized it was manageable?
I was in a race to finish the novel. I was in a race, kind of. I had to finish the novel before I die. But then 3 months became 6 months, it became a year, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And by that time, I was getting treatment through this particular pill. And so it was working for me. I talk about it this openly because there are many people in Africa or in Kenya who die, and people think it's something because they just die. They looked healthy yesterday, and everything, and then they die, and people think it must be witchcraft or something. Yeah, I think prostate is a silent killer, and every male should be checked for prostate at least once every year. I feel blessed that I've been more normal since, and I'm still taking pills for the prostate.
It's just sort of the fact as well, in terms of feeling blessed, the fact that you, as you said, weren't going for a checkup. It just so happened that you kind of came into the path of a doctor that was going to diagnose that.
In fact, I'm still very grateful to her. Unfortunately, we are now going on to legal divorce. But no matter what happens between us, I can never forget that moment. I never forget that moment.
And did you discover anything in that period of trying? Because obviously, I'm sure you were thinking about other things as well, and maybe the idea of getting your sort of affairs in order, all that sort of stuff. But did you get anything from the writing process of thinking you had such a short amount of time to do it that you've then carried on with? Or do you now feel quite relaxed about the amount of time you
might have? Oh, no, I don't. I was finished, and I don't have the same. I have these gaps, long gaps before something. But I don't want another illness for me to write the next novel.
Obviously.
But other things have happened in my life which have shocked me into an activity. One was in 1977 when I was taken to a maximum security prison for writing a play in my mother tongue, Gikuyu, Gaika Deda, to be performed by literary peasant workers of Kamerido Community Education Cultural Center, which we had created. And to me, it was so, oh my God, it's one of the best things I've ever done, to do that with a community and see them doing this great performance. And then instead of being applauded for it, I'm taken to a maximum security prison. That irony of being put in a maximum security prison because of writing in my mother tongue later became very important to me because they're thinking very seriously about the language situation. How come that an African government can put me in prison for writing in an African language? That irony struck me so much so because I had written similar critical even works about the Kenyan situation in my novels. Petals of blood, a grain of wheat, but nothing had been done to me. But writing in Gikuyu, my mother tongue, I'm put in prison, maximum security prison, by a Gikuyu speak language president. Jomo Kenyatta was our first president, and Jomo Kenyatta was a pioneer in writing in Gikuyu. In 1922, he found a magazine in Gikuyu, the first one in Gikuyu language, called Mwigwithania. So you can see the irony he's a pioneer in his field, and he puts in prison for following in his footsteps. right?
What was the, sorry for my ignorance on this then, but what was the reason for that being so politically out of order? Was, I mean, if you'd done the same thing in English, it wouldn't have had the effect. Yeah, I mean,
that's a question which came to me in prison. Why? I started to think about the language question in colonial, and I realized it's something is common among the French or the Portuguese colonists, and people, the idea of humiliating a child, now it horrifies me when I look at it, the idea of humiliating a child or giving them corporal punishment for speaking their mother tongue was so horrible. What set me in motion was my being in prison. But then I came to realize, look, it happened to the Scots, right? That's how they lost their language, more or less. It happens to Welsh people. The Welsh kids were told to carry something. If they're caught speaking Welsh in a school compound, they carried something in their neck called a Welsh knot, something, right? And the, you know, the Irish as well. In native, in America, the same thing to Native Americans. And their language, that's how they were humiliated for their language, punished even. It was same in New Zealand among the Maori. You know, it's the same pattern throughout the colonial system. That's when I start to think about the role of language in a colonial system. And later, when I came out of prison, my thinking became the book, Decolonizing the Mind. So what I'm trying to say is, harsh conditions can sometimes create, all right, think of writing as an impulse to life, to be, right? It's imagination. You want to break barriers or whatever. Anyway, I'm talking about myself, and that's definitely my being in prison conditions. In 1978, I created the first novel in Gikuyu language called Shaitan Mudrafaine, in English, Devil on the Cross. Right? And since then, since 1978, all my novels are in Gikuyu language first.
So, I mean, if prison was supposed to be a sort of sanction against having produced creative work in that language, it obviously catastrophically failed in terms of, I mean, it made you more determined to do it. And you wrote the first novel in
Gikuyu language. The enormity of the problem. And the more I think about, even today, the more I realize how it's a big problem for formerly colonized countries, whether in Americas, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Canada, in Africa, whether it's French-speaking Africa or Portuguese-speaking Africa or English-speaking Africa, the same pattern. Okay.
Donc, on vient de vous dire que la dernière période de mes recherches littéraires comporter une part d'autobiographie.
Just been told that the last phase of his literary research, his literary work, had been preoccupied with a kind of autobiographical search.
Et ça a causé une sorte de scandale littéraire.
It caused a kind of literary scandal.
Me give you another example. Japan. And South Korea, and Korea, not South Korea, but Korea. Japan colored Korea in 1910, and until they were defeated in 1945 by the British American. But during that time, they had already imposed Japanese on the Korean, and Japanese names on the Korean. And so the same pattern in Africa. You find Africa today, people calling themselves, there's hardly any African without, okay, let me start with myself. I used to call myself James Gogi or Jim James. And I realized as part of that rethinking the language issue, I started thinking also the naming system that comes with it. If you think of language, you think of language as a naming system. Mm-hmm. A language is a naming system. You name the world in a way to own the world or to know it. Yeah? So you find in all colonial situations, the colonizer always try to erase the language of the colonized, and someone impose their language, and even their own naming system onto the colonized. Yeah. And as I said, this has nothing to do with what the British, the French did it, the Portuguese, Spanish, everywhere. It's the same thing, same pattern.
Yeah, they, I mean, it is a very powerful tool, really, isn't it? Language to control and to, it's not, you can describe the world, but you can also control the world with it.
Yeah, control the mind, colonize the mind, because you find it's a way of controlling the mind in a sense that it's a way of controlling the mind of a community. I just tell people, no, there's nothing wrong in knowing many languages. There's absolutely nothing wrong. You know, English or French or Portuguese or Japanese is the relation between that language and the language of the colonized. You punish somebody for speaking there. You humiliate somebody for their mother tongue and glorify them for their English or their command of the colonized language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you do the other way around, where you know your mother tongue or the language of your culture, and then you add English or French or Russian, that's empowerment, right? But the other one is not empowerment, right?
Although I guess there's always the problem with the kind of hegemonic pressure of a language like English. Like, it is very useful for people to learn other languages, as you say. But if you're in a culture where there is a language that's, with the internet and things, for example, the sort of status and the wide usability of English starts to have a sort of shrinking effect on a mother tongue language, perhaps.
There are colonizers' language becomes the language of power. Mm. Because every community and every culture, there's either the language of power or even the accent of power. And I know this because when I went to Leeds, I came from Kenya, when I went to Leeds, Yorkshire people would say something like, hello, Lou, you know, love, you know, Lou, or something. And we used to laugh at them. We are from Kenya, we are African, right? And I'm laughing at the Yorkshire people for their command, you know, English. Or you go to East London, you know, and then you begin laughing. They don't know.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's a class-ridden society still. I'm sure lots of people, particularly those who are very privileged, would argue against that. But there is this thing, like the kind of that informal humiliation. People are sort of showing themselves to not have quite got the codes or the rules that they need to sort of prove themselves, you know. There is a snobbery about regional accents and dialects.
Power, because there was a time, say, among the so British, for instance, you know, you couldn't have got a job at BBC with a equal language accent for you. If you are from East London, there's no way you're going to get a job in BBC. Maybe now things have changed, right? Yeah. In other words, even within the language itself, there is the accent of power, right? Yeah.
And it's so ingrained, though, that consciousness, because I think things have changed now. But then I'll hear friends of my parents, for example, things like that, say, oh, you can't get onto the BBC now unless you've got a Yorkshire accent or a Newcastle accent or something. Yeah. You know? So that's people have really internalized the idea that there's the television way of speaking or whatever, the right way to speak.
Become more and more aware of language diversity. And it's not a bad thing for a culture to have diverse languages. And I call it the oxygen of culture. Many languages, and the British, for the poorer, for their suppression of the Scottish and Welsh, you know, okay, they lose something. Right? Anyway, what I was going to say, that all that thinking about language started when I was in prison, in a maximum security prison. Of course, later, that thinking has become enriched by my encounters with so many people. The other day, a Native American writer, she lives in Quechua, came all the way from New Orleans. She comes from Colombia. She came all the way to see me in California. Why? Because she had read my book, The Color of My Mind, and it spoke to her experience. I had a similar encounter in India and other places. It's a global thing.
Donc, on vient de vous dire que la dernière période
de mes recherches littéraires
comportait une part d'autobiographie.
Just been told that the last phase of his literary researches, his literary work, had been preoccupied with a kind of autobiographical search.
Et ça a causé une sorte de scandale littéraire.
It caused a kind of literary scandal.
So that's trouble. Because I had to fight with this notion that African languages are not either divisive against the nation or some negativity all the time. I wanted to show that you can write in Gikuyu, right? And the novel can be translated into English or any other language, but say to English first. So I write in Gikuyu, the book is available in English. You can do the same thing. You can have a book written in Welsh. It's available in English or in Gikuyu. Right, or in Russian, right? Yeah. So I do that. I did that really to break through this barrier, this blockage, this in the people's heads that if you have many languages, it's something negative, you know.
So was it a big change to write in your native language? To when you started that, was it sort of freeing and easy, or did you have to sort of start from scratch in a way?
Exactly, right, because you're so conditioned to thinking in English that you cannot do it in English. That's the problem. You're conditioned to think. You're so conditioned. I don't know how to describe it, but sometimes it's very difficult to. They cannot think outside the normality of English, right? Yeah, this English is normal. You know, yeah, but so initially I had those difficulties. The way I describe it is when I was writing in prison, committed mass exodus prison, I didn't have paper or pen, but I used what I had and got toilet paper to write on. But the thing is, you're writing something, and of course, you are stuck, you know, you think of a concept, and you're so used to thinking of that concept in English. So when I try to think it could, like, I describe it as a little devil, English-speaking devil, become a whisper. Hey, but Mr. Googie, I am ready here for you. Have a word for that right now here, you know, all right. So that was, I'm telling you, it may sound silly, but it's a big struggle. You're so conditioned to write in English that certain concepts don't come easily to you in Gikuyu, right? And you become frustrated. And you might say, oh, Gikuyu cannot do this.
And was it something you'd written in before at all? I mean, was it something you'd sort of write letters in and you'd read newspapers in? Or was it quite a common thing to read and write in? Or were you kind of, before you were in prison, was most of the text that you were writing all in English?
Yeah. I mean, everything was in English. Whatever I read was in English. Whatever I wrote was in English. I used to be a newspaper columnist. I write for the Daily Nation in Kenya, an English newspaper in Kenya, a column called As I See It. Every week, I wrote a column when I was an undergraduate at Makerere. I would get a column, As I See It. So, remember, newspapers, the readers in those days, even the radio station was largely in English. Whatever you did was in English, right? So English became the norm, or is normalized as a norm. Things are changing now. There are many radio stations in Kenya in different African languages. There are newspapers, the musicians are the best in so far as they have been at the forefront in singing in the different African languages. And that's fine. But conditioning, I'm telling you, is very difficult thing to break. That's why, for instance, the well-known Irish writer, James Joyce. Look at him. This icon of English literature is everywhere in there. I mean, and he's a great writer. I'm not dismissing his work. A great writer. You can see his love of words. Joyce knew Irish, but never wrote in Gaelic or Irish. He wrote in English. He may have been thinking that he was writing Irish literature, but it's nonsense. He wrote English literature, right? and writes in slow. He's now honored all over the world as an English language writer. Now in Ireland, there are a few writers now, I don't know how many, who write now in Irish. Those have a claim to the name Irish literature, not James Joyce. He's a great writer. He's an Irish great writer. That's fine. No problem. Joseph Conrad was Polish and started learning English at the age of 19. He wrote these great novels. They were in English, not Polish. So Conrad is an English writer, quite rightly so. And he's a very good writer. I like him very much. Don't get me wrong. Okay. But he never contributed anything to Polish literature, the language he knew as a child, and English they're learning at the age of 19. But now, rightly so, he is part of the canon of English literature. James Joyce is the same. Right? But now in Ireland, there are people who are writing Irish, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting with Joyce. I wonder how much he had a story, because he obviously had a joy of playing with the words, but I don't know if he ever, I don't know enough of his biography to know if he ever tried writing in Irish, or if that sort of struggle you were talking about between the way you're being conditioned to think in English and then the native tongue you speak naturally, there's a kind of friction, I guess.
George was much more aware of complexities of the language situation in theory. His practice did the opposite. Let me give you an example. In 1912, he published an article in an Italian magazine called, that article is called Ireland at the Bar. In this story, or this episode, he talks an Irish old man or woman, I can, you know. No, man, who is accused of killing a woman. But the trial judge and everybody is, the trial is in English. So this Irish man, whose life is in danger, right, is as dependent on the interpreter in English. Together. Yeah. So he would be asked a question, did something happen? And of course, he would take a long time to explain, blah, 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 whatever. And the interpreter says, he says, no, Your Honor. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. So that article, Ireland at the Bar, would tell me that he was very much aware of the language situation. But he chose, of course, the language of power, right? He tried in writing to smuggle some Irish words into English, but so what does that do to Irish language? Nothing.
Yeah, I bet there's some Irish in Finnegan's Wake, like quite a few other languages, but you could never say that that's, you know, a contribution to the literature of that language. He just probably put some in there.
People are there. Yeah, but rightly so, he is known as a great English writer. He's a celebrated English writer all over the world. He's there at the top. So also is Conrad.
But that sort of perpetuates that the kind of mental imprisonment, I guess, for people who think that there are these languages that great literature exists in, English and French. You know, they're the languages that real literature with a capital L happens in, and then exactly. The other languages are sort of day to day.
The mind is conditioned to think so, and to think that you can only become a writer, really be a writer, if you write in English or French. And a writer is a writer no matter what language they're using. After all, Tolstoy novel, The War and Peace, was not written in English, but we read about it in schools and other places, okay? French novels as well are quite well known in many through translation. And that's why my latest book is called The Language of Languages, because I've been giving lectures all over the world on translation and how languages can talk to each other. So I came to realize, actually, wait a minute, languages do talk, have a common language, and that common language is called translation, right? You know, the Bible is a translation of a translation of a translation in most cases. And it's fine. Greek writers are well known, in the students of English literature, Greek writers, playwrights are well known.
think, I mean, there's a really, there's a sense along with this sort of idea that, you know, English or French or, you know, there's languages that you should, that great novels are written in. There's also the original language is the one you have to read it in. But I think there is something that happens with translation that it's another version of the book, and it can be good as well. It doesn't have to, I mean, you can get bad translations, obviously, in which cases you don't want to read it. But when translation really works, it's adding something.
Jose Marquez from Colombia he wrote in Spanish. You know, the Colombian novelist. Jose Marquez, he's a very popular figure all over, in translation, of course. But he's also well known in his original Spanish. What I'm trying to say is all these things had to do with conditioning of power. Nothing more. It's nothing to do with languages, their beauty or not. And each language, and the way I put it like this, languages are like musical instruments. Each musical instrument has its own musicality. How do we know this? Because if you play a melody in piano, you know that sound is piano. And even when you got a piano and a guitar playing the same melody together, you'll be able to tell, oh, that sound is of the piano or the piano, and the sound, that sound is a guitar. Because of that musicality, each instrument has. The piano has it. The violin has it. And the sitar has it. The drum has it. But nowhere would any seriously thinking person would say, let us destroy all other musical instruments and leave only the sound of the piano.
That's a good analogy. I like that.
Say what we do with the languages, you know. All over the world, this notion that if you have one language, then you suppress the others. The same thing as saying, let's have only one piano. We destroy the violin. We destroy the guitar. We destroy all these things and have that one sound. But you can do it the other way around. What about orchestra? An orchestra is where you get the piano, the guitar, or the violin, or a number of, can be very many instruments, arranged in a certain way of equal give and take they produce. But with language, we don't, no. We must have only English language. But the irony is that when Western European countries when their cultures were dominated by Latin, and the Bible could only be read in Latin or whatever, the early English writers were mocked in the same way. How can you get medical terms in English, right? Yeah, they used to ask, right? Yeah. And you remember, I'm distorting history a little bit here, but it's true, that the first Englishman to translate the Bible from Latin into English, or from, he was later executed.
It was a highly political act, wasn't it?
I don't know whether he was, I'm not saying he was executed because of doing so, but I'm sorry about the irony. And then he was the first to do this, he was later killed.
So thank you to Ngugi for joining us for that chat. Thank you for listening.
We hope you enjoyed the show. Do remember to like, subscribe, tell your friends, send the podcast around the world.
Spread the word. You can find out more about the podcast at unsoundmethods.co.uk. That's a website. We're at unsoundmethods on Twitter, where we occasionally throw nonsense out. You can find out about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com or jamiebatchin on Twitter and jamie_batchin on Instagram.
You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Medium at lachlanbloom or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
Thanks.
Cool.